In a shed across the way, I noticed the shiny chrome prow of a tractor trailer poking out and asked Billy about it. He explained he'd had to take on long-distance hauling work to keep the farm afloat. "Have to drive the big rig to pay for all my farm toys," he chuckled. George tossed me a look, as if to say, "Kinda pathetic, isn't it?" Poignant seemed more like it, to think what this farmer had to do to hold on to his farm. I was reminded of Thoreau's line, "Men have become the tools of their tools." And I wondered if Billy gave much thought in those late-night hours rolling up the miles on Route 80 to how he got to this point, and about who he was really working for now. The bank? John Deere? Monsanto? Pioneer? Cargill? 220 bushels of corn is an astounding accomplishment, yet it didn't do Billy nearly as much good as it did those companies. And then, of course, there's the corn itself, which, if corn could form an opinion, would surely marvel at the absurdity of it all, and its great good fortune. For corn has been exempted from the usual rules of nature and economics, both of which have rough mechanisms to check any such wild, uncontrolled proliferation. In nature, the population of a species explodes until it exhausts its supply of food. Then it crashes. In the market, an oversupply of a commodity depresses prices until the surplus is either consumed or it no longer makes sense to produce any more of it. In corn's case, humans have labored mightily to free it from either constraint, even if that means going broke growing it and consuming it just as fast as we possibly can. Chapter 3. The Elevator. On the spring afternoon, I visited the grain elevator in Jefferson, Iowa, where George Naylor hauls his corn each October. The sky was a soft gray, drizzling lightly. Grain elevators, the only significant verticals for miles around this part of Iowa, resemble tight clusters of windowless concrete office towers. But this day, the cement sky had robbed them of contrast, rendering the great cylinders nearly invisible. What stood out as my car rumbled across the railroad tracks and past the green and white Iowa Farmers Cooperative sign was a bright yellow pyramid the size of a circus tent pitched near the base of the elevator. An immense pile of corn left out in the rain. The previous years had been a bumper crop in this part of the Midwest. The pile represents what's left of the millions of bushels of corn that overflowed the elevators last October. Even now, 7 months later, there was still a surfeit of corn, and I watched a machine that looked like a portable escalator pour several tons of it over the lip of a railroad car. As I circumnavigated the great pile, I started to see the golden kernels everywhere, ground into the mud by tires and boots, floating in the puddles of rainwater, pancaked on the steel rails. Most of this grain is destined for factory farms and processing plants, so no one worries much about keeping it particularly clean. Even so, it was hard not to register something deeply amiss in the sight of so much food lying around on the wet ground. In Ames, the following afternoon, I met a Mexican-American agronomist named Ricardo Salvador, a professor at Iowa State University, who told me he'd had a similar reaction the first time he'd seen kernels littering Iowa roads in October. Farmers haul their corn to town in big open wagons that fishtail across the county highways, scattering a light rain of yellow kernels as they go. To be honest, I felt a revulsion. In Mexico, even today, you do not let corn lay on the ground. It is considered almost sacrilegious. He sent me to a passage from a 16th-century writer, Friar Sahagún, who had chronicled the Aztecs' reverence for maize. If they saw dry grains of maize scattered on the ground, they quickly gathered them up, saying, "Our sustenance suffereth, it lieth weeping. If we should not gather it up, it would accuse us before our Lord. It would say, O our Lord, this vassal picked me not up when I lay scattered upon the ground. Punish him. Or perhaps we should starve." The agronomist's reaction, like mine, owes something to our confusion of corn the food with corn the commodity, which turn out to be two subtly but crucially different things. What George Naylor grows, and what the pile by the elevator consists of, is number 2 field corn, an internationally recognized commodity grown everywhere, and nowhere in particular. Fungible, traded in and speculated upon and accepted as a form of capital all over the world. And while number 2 field corn certainly looks like the corn you would eat and is directly descended from the maize Friar Sahagún's Aztecs worshipped as the source of life, it is less a food than an industrial raw material and an abstraction. The kernels are hard to eat, but if you soak them in water for several hours, you'll find they taste less like corn than lightly corn-flavored starch. Actually, there are many different kinds of corn heaped together in this pile. George Naylor's Pioneer Hybrid 34H31 mixed in with his neighbor Billy's genetically modified 33P67. Corn grown with atrazine mixed with corn grown with metalachlor. Number 2 corn is a lowest common denominator. All the designation tells you is that the moisture content of this corn is no more than 14%, and that fewer than 5% of the kernels exhibit insect damage. Other than that, this is the corn without qualities. Quantity is really the only thing that counts. Such corn is not something to feel reverent or even sentimental about, and nobody in Iowa, save the slightly embarrassed agronomist, does. Commodity corn, which is as much an economic abstraction as it is a biological fact, was invented in Chicago in the 1850s. The best account of the invention of agricultural commodities is in William Cronin's Nature's Metropolis, Chicago and the Great West, 1991. Before then, corn was bought and sold in burlap sacks. More often than not, the sacks bore the name of the farm where the corn had been grown. You could follow a sack from a farm in Iowa to the mill in Manhattan where it was ground into meal, or to the dairy in Brooklyn where it was fed to a cow. This made a difference. For most of history, farmers have had to think about the buyer of their crops, to worry about making sure their corn found its way to the right place at the right time, before it spoiled or got waylaid or its price collapsed. Farmers had to worry, too, about the quality of their corn, since customers didn't pay before sampling what was in the sack. In America before the 1850s, a farmer owned his sacks of corn up to the moment when a buyer took delivery, and so bore the risk for anything that went wrong between farm and table or trough. For better or worse, that burlap sack linked a corn buyer anywhere in America with a particular farmer cultivating a particular patch of the earth. With the coming of the railroads and the invention of the grain elevator, essentially a great vertical warehouse filled by conveyor belt and emptied by spigot, the sacks suddenly became a problem. Now it made sense to fill railroad cars and elevators by conveyor, to treat corn less as a certain number of discrete packages someone had to haul, and more like an unbounded liquid that could be pumped, in effect, by machine. Mix it all together in a great golden river. The river of corn would flow from the farms to the Chicago market and then out from there to buyers anywhere in the world. But before buyers would accept this new non-specific, trackless corn, they would have to have some assurance of its quality. The breakthrough came in 1856, when the Chicago Board of Trade instituted a grading system. Now any number 2 corn was guaranteed to be as good as any other number 2 corn. So there was no longer any reason for anyone to care where the corn came from or who grew it, as long as it met the board's standard. Since this standard was fairly minimal, specifying acceptable levels of insect damage, dirt and extraneous matter, and moisture, growers and breeders were now free to train their energies on producing bigger and bigger harvests. Before the commodity system, farmers prided themselves on a panoply of qualities in their crop. Big ears, plump kernels, straight rows, various colors. Even the height of their corn plants became a point of pride. Now, none of these distinctions mattered. Bushels per acre became the only boast you heard. No one could foresee it at the time, but the Chicago Board of Trade's decision redirected the evolution of Z. maize. From that moment on, the trajectory of the species' descent was guided by a single quality: yield, which is to say, the quality of sheer quantity. The invention of commodity grains severed any link between the producer of a foodstuff and its ultimate consumer. A commodity is like a filter, stripping qualities and histories from the harvest of a particular farm and farmer. When George Naylor delivers his wagon load to the elevator in Jefferson, which runs 24 hours a day, 7 days a week at the height of the harvest, his corn is weighed and graded. His account is credited with that day's posted price per bushel, and Naylor's worries about his crop, his responsibility for it, indeed his whole relationship to it, are over for another year. Within hours, Naylor's corn joins the streams of corn coming off his neighbor's farms. Later, that tributary flows from Jefferson County into the river of commodity corn flowing mostly east and south from Iowa into the tremendous maw of the American food system. Watching a pile of corn stream over the lip of a hopper car painted with Cargill's blue and yellow logo, a car destined to join a train more than a mile long and holding 440,000 bushels of corn, I began to see what George Naylor was getting at when he'd told me whom it was he grew his corn for: the military-industrial complex. The immense pyramid of corn I stood before in Jefferson is, of course, only a tiny part of an infinitely more immense mountain of corn dispersed over thousands of grain elevators across the American Corn Belt every autumn. That mountain is the product of the astounding efficiency of American corn farmers who, with their technology, machinery, chemicals, hybrid genetics, and sheer skill, can coax 5 tons of corn from an acre of Iowa soil. All this you can see with your own eyes, hanging around during the harvest. What is much harder to see is that all this corn is also the product of government policies, which have done more than anything else to raise that mountain and shrink the price of each bushel in it. The Iowa Farmers Cooperative does not write the only check George Naylor will receive for his corn crop this fall. He gets a second check from the U.S. Department of Agriculture, USDA, about 28 cents a bushel no matter what the market price of corn is, and considerably more should the price of corn drop below a certain threshold. Let's say the price of a bushel falls to $1.45, as it most recently did in October 2005. Since the official target price, called the loan rate, in Greene County stands at $1.87, the government would then send farmers another 42 cents in deficiency payments, for a total of 70 cents for every bushel of corn they can grow. Taken together, these federal payments account for nearly half the income of the average Iowa corn farmer and represent roughly a quarter of the $19 billion U.S. taxpayers spend each year on payments to farmers. This is a system designed to keep production high and prices low. In fact, it's designed to drive prices ever lower, since handing farmers deficiency payments, as compared to the previous system of providing loans to support prices, encourages them to produce as much corn as they possibly can, and then to dump it all on the market no matter what the price, a practice that inevitably pushes prices even lower. And as prices decline, the only way a farmer like George Naylor can keep his income from declining is by producing still more corn. So the mountain grows, from 4 billion bushels in 1970 to 10 billion bushels today. Moving that mountain of cheap corn, finding the people and animals to consume it, the cars to burn it, the new products to absorb it, and the nations to import it, has become the principal task of the industrial food system, since the supply of corn vastly exceeds the demand. Another way to look at this 10 billion bushel pile of commodity corn, a naturalist's way of looking at it, is that industrial agriculture has introduced a vast new stock of biomass to the environment, creating a kind of imbalance, a kind of vacuum in reverse. Ecology teaches that whenever an excess of organic matter arises anywhere in nature, creatures large and small inevitably step forward to consume it, sometimes creating whole new food chains in the process. In this case, the creatures feasting on the surplus biomass are both metaphorical and real. There are the agribusiness corporations, foreign markets, and whole new industries, such as ethanol. And then there are the food scientists, livestock, and human eaters, as well as the usual array of microorganisms, such as E. coli 0157H7. What's involved in absorbing all this excess biomass goes a long way toward explaining several seemingly unconnected phenomena, from the rise of factory farms and the industrialization of our food, to the epidemic of obesity and prevalence of food poisoning in America, to the fact that in the country where Z. maize was originally domesticated, campesinos descended from those domesticators are losing their farms because imported corn, flooding in from the north, has become too cheap. Such is the protean, paradoxical nature of the corn in that pile, that getting rid of it could contribute to obesity and to hunger both. My plan when I came to Iowa was to somehow follow George Naylor's corn on its circuitous path to our plates and into our bodies. I should have known that tracing any single bushel of commodity corn is as impossible as tracing a bucket of water after it's been poured into a river. Making matters still more difficult, the Golden River of American commodity corn, wide though it is, passes through a tiny number of corporate hands. Though the companies won't say, it has been estimated that Cargill and ADM together probably buy somewhere near a third of all the corn grown in America. These two companies now guide corn's path at every step of the way. They provide the pesticide and fertilizer to the farmers, operate most of America's grain elevators. Naylor's member-owned cooperative is an exception. Broker and ship most of the exports, perform the wet and dry milling, feed the livestock and then slaughter the corn-fattened animals, ferment the ethanol, and manufacture the high-fructose corn syrup and the numberless other fractions derived from number 2 field corn. Oh yes, and help write many of the rules that govern this whole game, for Cargill and ADM exert considerable influence over U.S. agricultural policies. More even than the farmers who receive the checks, and the political blame for cashing them, these companies are the true beneficiaries of the farm subsidies that keep the river of cheap corn flowing. Cargill is the biggest privately held corporation in the world. Cargill and ADM together comprise the vanishingly narrow sluice gate through which the great corn river passes every year. That gate is also virtually invisible. Neither company sells products directly to consumers, so they have little to gain from cooperating with journalists, and seldom do. Both companies decline to let me follow the corn river as it passes through their elevators, pipes, vats, tankers, freighters, feedlots, mills, and laboratories on its complex and increasingly obscure path to our bodies. The reason, they explained, is food security. Even so, it is possible to follow a bushel of George Naylor's corn, provided you are willing to regard it as the commodity it is. That is, treat it not as a specific physical entity you can hold in your hands, but as a generic, fungible quantity, no different from any other bushel of number 2 field corn boarding that Cargill train or any other. Since Naylor's corn is mixed in with all the other corn grown this year, the destinations of the kernels in any one of his bushels will mirror, more or less precisely, the ultimate destinations of the crop as a whole. Export, livestock, high fructose corn syrup, etc. So where do those 90,000 generic kernels wind up? After they've been milled and fractionated, processed and exported and passed through the guts of cows and chickens and pigs, what sort of meal do they make? And, at the risk of employing a word that might sound extreme attached to something as wholesome and all-American as corn, what sort of havoc can those 90,000 kernels wreak? The place where most of those kernels wind up, about 3 of every 5, is on the American factory farm, a place that could not exist without them. Here, hundreds of millions of food animals that once lived on family farms and ranches are gathered together in great commissaries, where they consume as much of the mounting pile of surplus corn as they can digest, turning it into meat. Enlisting the cow in this undertaking has required particularly heroic efforts, since the cow is by nature not a corn eater. But nature abhors a surplus, and the corn must be consumed. Enter the corn-fed American steer. End of Disc 2. Chapter 4. The Feedlot. Making Meat. 54,000 Kernels. Cattle Metropolis. The landscape that corn has made in the American Middle West is unmistakable. It forms a second great American lawn, unfurling through the summer like an absurdly deep pile carpet of green across the vast lands drained by the Mississippi River. Corn, the plant, has colonized some 125,000 square miles of the American continent, an area twice the size of New York State. Even from outer space, you can't miss it. It takes a bit more looking, however, to see some of the other landscapes that corn, the commodity, has created in obscure places like Garden City, Kansas. Here in the high plains of western Kansas is where America's first feedlots were built, beginning in the early 50s. You'll be speeding down one of Finney County's ramrod roads when the empty, dun-colored January prairie suddenly turns black and geometric. An urban grid of steel-fenced rectangles as far as the eye can see, which in Kansas is really far. I say suddenly, but in fact the swiftly rising odor, an aroma whose Proustian echoes are decidedly more bus station men's room than cows in the country, has been heralding the feedlot's approach for more than a mile. And then it's upon you. Pokey Feeders, population 37,000. A sloping subdivision of cattle pens stretches to the horizon, each one home to 100 or so animals standing dully or lying around in a grayish mud. It eventually dawns on you that it isn't mud at all. The pens line a network of unpaved roads that loop around vast waste lagoons on their way to the feed yard's loudly beating heart and dominating landmark. A rhythmically chugging feed mill that rises, soaring and silvery in the early morning light, like an industrial cathedral in the midst of a teeming metropolis of meat. As it does 12 hours a day, 7 days a week, the mill is thunderously converting America's river of corn into cattle feed. I'd traveled to Pokey early one January with the slightly improbable notion of visiting one particular resident, though as I nosed my rental car through the feedlot's rolling black sea of bovinity, I began to wonder if this was realistic. I was looking for a young black steer with three white blazes on his face that I'd met the previous fall on a ranch in Vail, South Dakota, 500 miles due north of here. In fact, the steer I hoped to find belonged to me. I'd purchased him as an 8-month-old calf from the Blair Ranch for $598. I was paying Pokey Feeders $1.60 a day for his room and board, all the corn he could eat, and meds. My interest in this steer was not strictly financial or even gustatory. No, my primary interest in this animal was educational. I wanted to learn how the industrial food chain transforms bushels of corn into steaks. How do you enlist so unlikely a creature? For the cow is an herbivore by nature, to help dispose of America's corn surplus. By far the biggest portion of a bushel of American commodity corn, about 60% of it, or some 54,000 kernels, goes to feeding livestock, and most of that goes to feeding America's 100 million beef cattle. Cows and bulls and steers that in times past spent most of their lives grazing on grasses out on the prairie. America's food animals have undergone a revolution in lifestyle in the years since World War II. At the same time much of America's human population found itself leaving the city for the suburbs, our food animals found themselves traveling in the opposite direction, leaving widely dispersed farms in places like Iowa to live in densely populated new animal cities. These places were so different from farms and ranches that a new term was needed to denote them.
CAFO, Confined Animal Feeding Operation.
Both the new animal and human landscapes were products of government policy. The post-war suburbs would never have been built if not for the interstate highway system, as well as the GI Bill and federally subsidized mortgages. The urbanization of America's animal population would never have taken place if not for the advent of cheap, federally subsidized corn. Corn itself profited from the urbanization of livestock twice. As the animals left the farm, more of the farm was left for corn, which rapidly colonized the paddocks and pastures and even the barnyards that had once been the animals' territory.
The animals left because the farmers simply couldn't compete with the CAFOs. It cost a farmer more to grow feed corn than it cost a CAFO to buy it, for the simple reason that commodity corn now was routinely sold for less than it cost to grow.
Corn profited again as the factory farms expanded, absorbing increasing amounts of its surplus. Corn found its way into the diet of animals that never used to eat very much of it, like cattle, or any corn at all, like the farmed salmon now being bred to tolerate grain. All that excess biomass has to go somewhere.
The economic logic of gathering so many animals together to feed them cheap corn in CAFOs is hard to argue with. It has made meat, which used to be a special occasion in most American homes, so cheap and abundant that many of us now eat it three times a day. Not so compelling is the biological logic behind this cheap meat. Already in their short history, CAFOs have produced more than their share of environmental and health problems. Polluted water and air, toxic wastes, novel and deadly pathogens.
Raising animals on old-fashioned mixed farms such as the Naylors used to make a simple biological sense. You can feed them the waste products of your crops, and you can feed their waste products to your crops. In fact, when animals live on farms, the very idea of waste ceases to exist. What you have instead is a closed ecological loop, what in retrospect you might call a solution. One of the most striking things that animal feedlots do, to paraphrase Wendell Berry, is to take this elegant solution and neatly divide it into two new problems. A fertility problem on the farm, which must be remedied with chemical fertilizers, and a pollution problem on the feedlot, which seldom is remedied at all.
This biological absurdity, characteristic of all CAFOs, is compounded in the cattle feed yard by a second absurdity.
Here, animals exquisitely adapted by natural selection to live on grass must be adapted by us, at considerable cost to their health, to the health of the land, and ultimately to the health of their eaters, to live on corn, for no other reason than it offers the cheapest calories around and because the great pile must be consumed. This is why I decided to follow the trail of industrial corn through a single steer rather than, say, a chicken or a pig, which can get by just fine on a diet of grain. The short, unhappy life of a corn-fed feedlot steer represents the ultimate triumph of industrial thinking over the logic of evolution. Pastoral, Vail, South Dakota. The Blair Ranch occupies 5,500 acres of rolling short grass prairie a few miles outside Sturgis, South Dakota, and directly in the shadow of Bear Butte. The Bismarck Deadwood Trail crossed their land just to the north of the butte, which rises dramatically from the plains like a chubby 10-story exclamation mark. You can still make out ruts in the turf dug by stagecoaches and cattle drives the century before last. The turf itself in November, when I visited, forms a luxuriant pelt of grass oscillating yellow and gold in the constant wind and sprinkled with perambulating black dots. Angus cows and calves grazing. Ed and Rich Blair run what's called a cow-calf operation, the first stage in the production of a hamburger and the stage least changed by the modern industrialization of meat. While the pork and chicken industries have consolidated the life cycle of those animals under a single roof, beef cattle still get born on hundreds of thousands of independently owned ranches scattered mainly across the West.
Although a mere four giant meatpacking companies, Tyson subsidiary IBP, Cargill subsidiary Excel, Swift & Company, and National, now slaughter and market four of every five beef cattle born in this country, that concentration represents the narrow end of a funnel that starts out as wide as the Great Plains. These corporations have concluded that it takes so much land, and therefore capital, to produce a calf ready for the feedlot, 10 acres per head at a minimum, that they're better off leaving the ranching and the risk to the ranchers. Steer number 534 spent his first 6 months in these lush pastures alongside his mother, 9534. The number signifies she was the 34th cow born in 1995. Since none of her male offspring stick around long enough to meet, they're all named 534. His father was a registered Angus by the name of Gar Precision 1680, a bull distinguished by the size and marbling of his offspring's ribeye steaks. Gar Precision's only contact with 9534 came by way of a $15 mail-order straw of his semen. Born on March 13, 2001, in the birthing shed across the road, 534 and his mother were turned out on pasture just as soon as the 80-pound calf stood up and began nursing. Within a few weeks, the calf began supplementing his mother's milk by nibbling on a salad bar of mostly native grasses: western wheatgrass, little bluestem, buffalo grass, green needlegrass. Apart from the trauma of the Saturday in April when he was branded and castrated, one could imagine 534 looking back on those 6 months as the good old days. It might be foolish for us to presume to know what a cow experiences, yet we can say that a calf grazing on grass is at least doing what he has been supremely well suited by evolution to do. Oddly enough, though, eating grass is something that after October, my steer will never have the opportunity to do again. The coevolutionary relationship between cows and grass is one of nature's underappreciated wonders. It also happens to be the key to understanding just about everything about modern meat. For the grasses, which have evolved to withstand the grazing of ruminants, the cow maintains and expands their habitat by preventing trees and shrubs from gaining a foothold and hogging the sunlight. The animal also spreads grass seed, plants it with his hooves, and then fertilizes it with his manure. In exchange for these services, the grasses offer ruminants a plentiful and exclusive supply of lunch. For cows, like sheep, bison, and other ruminants, have evolved the special ability to convert grass, which single-stomached creatures like us can't digest, into high-quality protein. They can do this because they possess what is surely the most highly evolved digestive organ in nature, the rumen. About the size of a medicine ball, the organ is essentially a 45-gallon fermentation tank in which a resident population of bacteria dines on grass. Living their unseen lives at the far end of the food chain that culminates in a hamburger, these bacteria have, like the grasses, co-evolved with the cow whom they feed. Truly, this is an excellent system for all concerned. For the grasses, for the bacteria, for the animals, and for us, the animals' eaters. While it is true that overgrazing can do ecological harm to a grassland, in recent years ranchers have adopted rotational grazing patterns that more closely mimic the patterns of the bison, a ruminant that sustainably grazed these same grasses for thousands of years before the cow displaced it. In fact, a growing number of ecologists now believe the rangelands are healthier with cattle on them, provided they're moved frequently. Today, the most serious environmental harm associated with the cattle industry takes place on the feedlot. In fact, growing meat on grass makes superb ecological sense. It is a sustainable, solar-powered food chain that produces food by transforming sunlight into protein. Row crops could accomplish this trick too, but not around here. In places like western South Dakota, the land is far too arid, thin, and hilly to grow crops without large amounts of irrigation, chemicals, and erosion. My cattle can take low-quality forage and convert it into a pretty desirable product, Rich Blair pointed out. If you didn't have ruminant animals, all this... He gestures to the high plains rolling out from his ranch in every direction, would be the Great American Desert. So then why is it that steer number 534 hasn't tasted a blade of prairie grass since October? Speed, in a word, or in the industry's preferred term, efficiency. Cows raised on grass simply take longer to reach slaughter weight than cows raised on a richer diet. And for half a century now, the industry has devoted itself to shortening a beef animal's allotted span on Earth. In my grandfather's time, cows were 4 or 5 years old at slaughter, Rich explained. In the 50s, when my father was ranching, it was 2 or 3 years old. Now we get there at 14 to 16 months. Fast food indeed. What gets a steer from 80 to 1,100 pounds in 14 months are tremendous quantities of corn, protein and fat supplements, and an arsenal of new drugs. Weaning marks the fateful moment when the natural evolutionary logic represented by a ruminant grazing on grass bumps up against the industrial logic that will propel the animal on the rest of its swift journey to a wholesale box of beef. This industrial logic is rational and even irresistible. After all, it has succeeded in making beef everyday fare for millions of people for whom it once represented a luxury. And yet, the further you follow it, the more likely you are to begin wondering if that rational logic might not also be completely mad. In October, 2 weeks before I made his acquaintance, steer number 534 was weaned from his mother. Weaning is perhaps the most traumatic time on a ranch for animals and ranchers alike. Cows separated from their calves will mope and bellow for days, and the calves, stressed by the change in circumstance and diet, are prone to getting sick. Calves are weaned for a couple of reasons. To free their mothers to have more calves, 9534 had already been inseminated again in June, and to get the animals, now 500 or 600 pounds, ready for life on the feedlot. The animals are rounded up and herded into a backgrounding pen, where they'll spend a couple of months before boarding the truck for pokey feeders. Think of backgrounding as prep school for feedlot life. The animals are, for the first time in their lives, confined to a pen, bunk broken, taught to eat from a trough, and gradually accustomed to eating what is for them a new and unnatural diet. Here is where the rumen first encounters corn. It was in the backgrounding pen that I first made the acquaintance of 534. Before coming to Vail, I'd told the Blairs I wanted to follow one of their steers through the life cycle. Ed Blair, the older of the brothers, suggested only half in jest that I might as well go whole hog and buy the animal if I really wanted to appreciate the challenges of ranching. This immediately struck me as a promising idea. Ed and Rich told me what to look for. A broad, straight back and thick shoulders. Basically, a sturdy frame on which to hang a lot of meat. I was also looking for a memorable face in this black Angus sea, one that I could pick out of the crowd at the feedlot. Almost as soon as I began surveying the 90 or so animals in the pen, 534 moseyed up to the railing and made eye contact. He had a wide, stout frame and was brockle-faced. He had 3 easy-to-spot white blazes. Here was my boy. Industrial, Garden City, Kansas. Traveling from the ranch to the feed yard, as 534 and I both did, in separate vehicles, the first week of January feels a lot like going from the country to the big city. A feedlot is very much a pre-modern city, however, teeming and filthy and stinking, with open sewers, unpaved roads, and choking air rendered visible by dust. The urbanization of the world's livestock being a fairly recent historical development, it makes a certain sense that cow towns, like pokey feeders, would recall human cities centuries ago, in the days before modern sanitation. As in 14th century London, say, the workings of the metropolitan digestion remain vividly on display, the foodstuffs coming in, the streams of waste going out. The crowding into tight quarters of recent arrivals from all over, together with the lack of sanitation, has always been a recipe for disease. The only reason contemporary animal cities aren't as plague-ridden or pestilential as their medieval human counterparts is a single historical anomaly: the modern antibiotic. I spent the better part of a day at Pokey Feeders, walking the streets, cattle watching, looking up my steer, and touring local landmarks like the towering feed mill. In any city, it's easy to lose track of nature, of the transactions between various species and the land on which everything ultimately depends. Back on the ranch, the underlying ecological relationship could not have been more legible. It is a local food chain built upon grass and the ruminants that can digest grass, and it draws its energy from the sun. But what about here? As the long shadow of the mill suggests, the feedlot is a city built upon America's mountain of surplus corn. Or rather, corn plus the various pharmaceuticals a ruminant must have if it is to tolerate corn. Yet, having started out from George Naylor's farm, I understood that the corn on which this place runs is implicated in a whole other set of ecological relationships, powered by a very different source of energy: the fossil fuel it takes to grow all that corn. So if the modern CAFO is a city built upon commodity corn, it is a city afloat on an invisible sea of petroleum. How this peculiar state of affairs came to seem sensible is a question I spent my day at Pokey trying to answer. It was only natural that I start my tour at the feed mill, the feedlot's thundering hub, where 3 meals a day for 37,000 animals are designed and mixed by computer. 1,000,000 pounds of feed pass through the mill each day. Every hour of every day, a tractor trailer pulls up to the loading dock to deliver another 50 tons of corn. The driver opens a valve in the belly of the truck, and a golden stream of grain, one thin rivulet of the great corn river coursing out of the Middle West, begins to flow, dropping down a chute into the bowels of the mill. Around to the other side of the building, tanker trucks back up in silo-shaped tanks into which they pump thousands of gallons of liquefied fat and protein supplements. In a shed attached to the mill sit vats of liquid vitamins and synthetic estrogen, beside pallets stacked with 50-pound sacks of antibiotics, rumensin and tylosin. Along with alfalfa hay and silage, for roughage, all these ingredients will be automatically blended and then piped into the parade of dump trucks that 3 times a day fan out from here to keep Pokey's 8.5 miles of trough filled. The feed mill's pulsing din is the sound of 2 giant steel rollers turning against one another 12 hours a day, crushing steamed corn kernels into warm and fragrant flakes. Flaking the corn makes it easier for cattle to digest it. This was the only feed ingredient I sampled, and it wasn't half bad. Not as crisp as a Kellogg's flake, but with a cornier flavor. I passed on the other ingredients. The liquefied fat, which on today's menu is beef tallow, trucked in from one of the nearby slaughterhouses, and the protein supplement, a sticky brown goop consisting of molasses and urea. The urea is a form of synthetic nitrogen made from natural gas, similar to the fertilizer spread on George Naylor's fields. Before being put on this highly concentrated diet, new arrivals to the feed yard are treated to a few days of fresh, long-stemmed hay. They don't eat on the long ride and can lose up to 100 pounds, so their rumens need to be carefully restarted. Over the next several weeks, they'll gradually step up to a daily ration of 32 pounds of feed, 75% of which is corn, a half bushel a day. What got corn onto the menu at this and almost every other American feedlot is price, of course, but also USDA policy, which for decades has sought to help move the mountain of surplus corn by passing as much of it as possible through the digestive tracts of food animals, who can convert it into protein. We've come to think of corn-fed as some kind of old-fashioned virtue, which it may well be when you're referring to Midwestern children, but feeding large quantities of corn to cows for the greater part of their lives is a practice neither particularly old or virtuous. Its chief advantage is that cows fed corn, a compact source of caloric energy, get fat quickly. Their flesh also marbles well, giving it a taste and texture American consumers have come to like. Yet this corn-fed meat is demonstrably less healthy for us, since it contains more saturated fat and less omega-3 fatty acids than the meat of animals fed grass. A growing body of research suggests that many of the health problems associated with eating beef are really problems with corn-fed beef. Modern-day hunter-gatherers who subsist on wild meat don't have our rates of heart disease. In the same way ruminants are ill-adapted to eating corn, humans in turn may be poorly adapted to eating ruminants that eat corn. Yet the USDA's grading system has been designed to reward marbling, a more appealing term than intramuscular fat, which is what it is, and thus the feeding of corn to cattle. Indeed, corn has become so deeply ingrained in the whole system of producing beef in America that whenever I raised any questions about it among ranchers or feedlot operators or animal scientists, people look at me as if I'd just arrived from another planet. Or perhaps from Argentina, where excellent steaks are produced on nothing but grass. The economic logic behind corn is unassailable, and on a factory farm there is no other kind. Calories are calories, and corn is the cheapest, most convenient source of calories on the market. Of course, it was the same industrial logic, protein is protein, that made feeding rendered cow parts back to cows seem like a sensible thing to do, until scientists figured out that this practice was spreading bovine spongiform encephalopathy, BSE, more commonly known as mad cow disease. Rendered bovine meat and bone meal represented the cheapest, most convenient way of satisfying a cow's protein requirement. Never mind these animals were herbivores by evolution, and so appeared on the daily menus of poke and most other feed yards until the FDA banned the practice in 1997. We now understand that while at a reductive molecular level protein may indeed be protein, at an ecological or species level this isn't quite true. As cannibal tribes have discovered, eating the flesh of one's own species carries special risks of infection. Kuru, a disease bearing a striking resemblance to BSE, spread among New Guinea tribesmen who ritually ate the brains of their dead kin. Some evolutionary biologists believe that evolution selected against cannibalism as a way to avoid such infections. Animals' aversion to their own feces and the carcasses of their species may represent a similar strategy. Through natural selection, animals have developed a set of hygiene rules, functioning much like taboos. One of the most troubling things about factory farms is how cavalierly they flout these evolutionary rules, forcing animals to overcome deeply ingrained aversions. We make them trade their instincts for antibiotics. Though the industrial logic that made feeding cattle to cattle seem like a good idea has been thrown into doubt by mad cow disease, I was surprised to learn it hadn't been discarded. The Food and Drug Administration, FDA, ban on feeding ruminant protein to ruminants makes an exception for blood products and fat. My steer will probably dine on beef tallow recycled from the very slaughterhouse he's heading to in June. Fat is fat. The feedlot manager shrugged when I raised an eyebrow. Though pokey doesn't do it, the rules still permit feedlots to feed non-ruminant animal protein to ruminants. Feather meal and chicken litter, that is, bedding, feces, and discarded bits of feed, are accepted cattle feeds, as are chicken, fish, and pig meal. Some public health experts worry that since the bovine meat and bone meal that cows used to eat is now being fed to chickens, pigs, and fish, infectious prions could find their way back into cattle when they're fed the protein of the animals that have been eating them. Before mad cow disease, remarkably few people in the cattle business, let alone the general public, comprehended the strange new semi-circular food chain that industrial agriculture had devised for the beef animal. And so, in turn, for the beef eater. When I mentioned to Rich Blair how surprised I'd been to learn cattle were eating cattle, he said, "To tell you the truth, it was kind of a shock to me, too." Compared to all the other things we feed cattle these days, corn seems positively wholesome. And yet it, too, violates the biological or evolutionary logic of bovine digestion. During my day at Pokey, I spent a few hours with Dr. Mel Metzen, the staff veterinarian, learning more than any beef eater really should know about the gastrointestinal life of the modern cow. Dr. Mel, as he's known at Pokey, oversees a team of 8 cowboys who spend their days riding the yard's dusty streets, spotting sick animals and bringing them into Pokey's 3 hospitals for treatment. Most of the health problems that afflict feedlot cattle can be traced either directly or indirectly to their diet. They're made to eat forage, Dr. Metzen explained, and we're making them eat grain. It's not that they can't adjust, he continues, and now we're breeding cattle to do well in a feed yard. One way to look at the breeding work going on at ranches like the Blairs is that the contemporary beef cow is being selected for the ability to eat large quantities of corn and efficiently convert it to protein without getting too sick. These, after all, are precisely the genes prized in 534's father, Gar Precision 1680. The species is evolving, in other words, to help absorb the excess biomass coming off America's cornfields. But the cow's not there quite yet, and a great many feedlot cattle, virtually all of them to one degree or another, according to several animal scientists I talked to, are simply sick. Bloat is perhaps the most serious thing that can go wrong with a ruminant on corn. The fermentation in the rumen produces copious amounts of gas, which is normally expelled by belching during rumination. But when the diet contains too much starch and too little roughage, rumination all but stops, and a layer of foamy slime forms in the rumen that can trap the gas. The rumen inflates like a balloon until it's pressing against the animal's lungs. Unless action is taken promptly to relieve the pressure, usually by forcing a hose down the animal's esophagus, the animal suffocates. A concentrated diet of corn can also give a cow acidosis. Unlike our own highly acid stomachs, the normal pH of a rumen is neutral. Corn renders it acidic, causing a kind of bovine heartburn that in some cases can kill the animal, but usually just makes him sick. Acidotic animals go off their feed, pant and salivate excessively, paw and scratch their bellies, and eat dirt. The condition can lead to diarrhea, ulcers, bloat, ruminitis, liver disease, and a general weakening of the immune system that leaves the animal vulnerable to the full panoply of feedlot diseases. Pneumonia, coccidiosis, enterotoxemia, feedlot polio, etc. Much like modern humans, modern cattle are susceptible to a set of relatively new diseases of civilization, assuming, that is, we're willing to put the modern feedlot under the rubric of civilization. Cattle rarely live on feedlot diets for more than 150 days, which might be about as much as their systems can tolerate. I don't know how long you could feed them this ration before you'd see problems, Dr. Metzen said. Another vet told me the diet would eventually blow out their livers and kill them. Over time, the acids eat away at the rumen wall, allowing bacteria to enter the animal's bloodstream. These microbes wind up in the liver, where they form abscesses and impair the liver's function. Between 15% and 30% of feedlot cows are found at slaughter to have abscessed livers. Dr. Mel told me that in some pens, the figure runs as high as 70%. What keeps a feedlot animal healthy, or healthy enough, are antibiotics. Rumensin buffers acidity in the rumen, helping to prevent bloat and acidosis. Antilosin, a form of erythromycin, lowers the incidence of liver infection. Most of the antibiotics sold in America today end up in animal feed, a practice that, it is now generally acknowledged, except in agriculture, is leading directly to the evolution of new antibiotic-resistant superbugs. In the debate over the use of antibiotics in agriculture, a distinction is usually made between their clinical and non-clinical use. Public health advocates don't object to treating sick animals with antibiotics. They just don't want to see the drugs lose their effectiveness because factory farms are feeding them to healthy animals to promote growth. But the use of antibiotics in feedlot cattle confounds this distinction. Here the drugs are plainly being used to treat sick animals, yet the animals probably wouldn't be sick if not for the diet of grain we feed them. I asked Dr. Mel what would happen if drugs like rumensin and tylosin were banned from cattle feed, as some public health experts advocate. We'd have a high death rate. It's currently about 3%, matching the industry average, and poorer performing cattle. We just couldn't feed them as hard. The whole system would have to change and slow down. Hell, if you gave them lots of grass and space, I wouldn't have a job. My first impression of Pen 63, where my steer is spending his last 5 months, was not a bad little piece of real estate, all considered. The pen is far enough from the feed mill to be fairly quiet, and it has a water view of what I thought was a pond or reservoir until I noticed the brown scum. The body of water is what is known in the geography of CAFOs as a manure lagoon. I asked the feedlot manager why they didn't just spray the liquefied manure on neighboring farms. The farmers don't want it, he explained. The nitrogen and phosphorus levels are so high that spraying the crops would kill them. He didn't say that feedlot wastes also contain heavy metals and hormone residues, persistent chemicals that end up in waterways downstream, where scientists have found fish and amphibians exhibiting abnormal sex characteristics. CAFOs like Pokey transform what at the proper scale would be a precious source of fertility, cow manure, into toxic waste. The pen 534 lives in is surprisingly spacious, about the size of a hockey rink, with a concrete feed bunk along the road and a fresh water trough out back. I climbed over the railing and joined the 90 steers, which, en masse, retreated a few lumbering steps and then stopped to see what I would do. I had on the same carrot-colored sweater I'd worn to the ranch in South Dakota, hoping to elicit some glint of recognition from my steer. I couldn't find him at first. All the faces staring at me were either completely black or bore an unfamiliar pattern of white marks. And then I spotted him, the three white blazes way off in the back. As I gingerly stepped toward him, the quietly shuffling mass of black cowhide between us parted, and there stood 534 and I, staring dumbly at one another. Glint of recognition? None. None whatsoever. I told myself not to take it personally. 534 and his pen mates have been bred for their marbling, after all, not their ability to form attachments. I noticed that 534's eyes looked a little bloodshot. Dr. Metzen had told me that some animals are irritated by feedlot dust. The problem is especially serious in the summer months, when the animals kick up clouds of the stuff and workers have to spray the pens with water to keep it down. I had to remind myself that this is not ordinary dirt dust, inasmuch as the dirt in a feed yard is not ordinary dirt. No, this is fecal dust. But apart from the air quality, how did feedlot life seem to be agreeing with 534? I don't know enough about the emotional life of a steer to say with confidence that 534 was miserable, bored, or indifferent, but I would not say he looked happy. He's clearly eating well, though. My steer had put on a couple hundred pounds since we'd last met, and he looked it. Thicker across the shoulder and round as a barrel through the middle. He carried himself more like a steer now than a calf, even though his first birthday was still 2 months away. Dr. Metzen complimented me on his size and conformation. That's a handsome-looking beef you got there. Shucks. If I stared at my steer hard enough, I could imagine the white lines of the butcher's chart dissecting his black hide. Rump roast, flank steak, standing rib, tenderloin, brisket. One way of looking at 534, the feedlot way, the industrial way, was as a most impressive machine for turning number two field corn into cuts of beef. Every day between now and his slaughter in 6 months, 534 will convert 32 pounds of feed into 4 pounds of gain. New muscle, fat, and bone. This, at least, is how 534 appears in the computer program I'd seen at the mill. The ratio of feed to gain that determines his efficiency. Compared to other food animals, cattle are terribly inefficient. The ratio of feed to flesh in chicken, the most efficient animal by this measure, is 2 pounds of corn to one of meat, which is why chicken costs less than beef. Pokey Feeders is indeed a factory, transforming, as fast as bovinely possible, cheap raw materials into a less cheap finished product through the mechanism of bovine metabolism. Yet metaphors of the factory and the machine obscure as much